Hi there, I'm Corey Rabin, and welcome to Crosstalk Podcast, where we do our part to inspire recovery from addiction and find a better way. Whether you're considering a life free from substance dependency or you're already on that path, Crosstalk is here for you. Each episode, we do a deep dive into the experiences and stories of people who've walked the walk of recovery alongside experts in the field to enhance our understanding of addiction and recovery. Our mission is simple: to help you navigate the challenges and celebrate the victories along your personal journey to a better life. So buckle up as we hit the road together as we embark on this transformative journey. This is Crosstalk Podcasts, and we have a terrific episode today. Not only do we have somebody who's a legend in South Florida in helping the recovery community, but also somebody who's in recovery themselves. Irene, are you as excited as I am?
I am very excited, Corey.
So tell everybody who's here.
All right, welcome to Crosstalk. My name's Irene, and thank you so much, Dr. Jonas, for joining us today. Dr. Harold Jonas, who has this incredible company called Sober Life, is going to tell us today his story.
Okay, well, thank you all for having me, and great setting to be hanging out. Sunday afternoon, South Florida. So here I am, many years later, after getting off a plane in 1987, West Palm Beach, and picked up by an actively using father. So that's the jump off point to be here. Prior to getting to that point, we're talking about life in Center City, Philadelphia, growing up in the 50s and 60s. During the intense changes that were happening in America, in the States, in the East Coast, in Philly. I was there when Dr. Martin Luther King was killed, junior high school, the tension that was so thick, it erupted into violence everywhere. Wow. So imagine, I'm not a big guy, and it took me a long time to get to where I'm at. I was a very late bloomer. So getting bullied, being picked on was very part of the norm. Not feeling good enough was always part of my life, always that I can remember. My father was commuting to South Jersey for his business that had gotten kind of pushed out of where it was. And the opportunity arose, timing was what it was, and we had joined the white flight out of the city into the suburbs. We landed in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. And at 14 years old, I went from being a city kid, completely independent, autonomous, on the public transportation, to getting on a yellow school bus. This did not fit really well in my scheme of like how life was, even though it looked good on TV. Mm. It didn't look good in my world. So when I started to smoke pot at 12, this became a pretty much daily ritual of getting and using and finding ways and means to get more. I got introduced to marijuana by my older sister, who had left the house due to the trauma in our family system. It was a very violent household, shall we say? That's a little quick summary.
12, you were in Philly.
When I was in 12. Philly 12, and then 13, 14, I'm in South Jersey now.
And Cherry Hill's a pretty affluent area.
Now it has become well known as that affluent. Cherry Hill Mall was the centerpiece of the community. There was a new high school, blah, blah, blah. Predominantly white, a lot of a different ghetto that I grew up in, the Jewish ghetto I came from, to a different one. There was more mixed religious beliefs going on, but there was still a lot of predominant Jewish people hanging out. But pot was a part of life, and alcohol was a part of the family system. So when I got introduced to pot, I became part of the family. Finally, I fit in because everybody else drank, and I couldn't really get it past my nose. It was really horrific for me. So marijuana made me feel connected to the system, being my dad, my mother, my older sister.
Everybody used.
Drank and smoked cigarettes. I mean, that's what the family did. So there was a, I'm named as a tradition in Jewish culture. I'm the firstborn after the last died. So I'm named after my Uncle Harold, who I never got to meet, obviously. And this is my father's middle brother. He's the runt. And Harold died tragically in a truck wreck, from what this story was.
Alcohol related, or you don't know?
I don't know. The stories in the family.
Yeah.
All I know is that my grandmother never called me by my name, because this was her favorite child, firstborn son. And so my father got whatever he didn't get. He was a depression baby in 1924, so he got less than nothing, parenting wise as well as everything else. So that was the style of parenting that he then provided for us. He was a provider first, and this whole thing about parenting was kind of like in the wind. As many men of that generation we've come to be,
I'm familiar.
They're all coming out of the Korean War, World War II. They had no clue. Mad Men. I mean,
yeah.
You know, basically that's what we're talking about. You know, come here, sweetie. There was a list of adjectives that he would refer to women as, usually food groups.
Right.
And sweet food groups.
I mean, I've heard it because I think I'm the generation right after that.
Right after,
so
sure.
It was still accepted when I was younger to use those.
Honey babe.
Yeah. And
honey pie.
And sometimes
sweetie.
I don't think it's so bad, I guess, but
sweetie,
it's because I'm a product of, you know.
Yeah. And we're talking about the servers in the restaurants, and we're talking South Jersey diners and everything, and you could pat them on the ass on the way by, and it was nobody thought anything of it. That was the way it was. That's what I got modeled. That's what I was.
Today you'll get a slap in the head.
Today you'll get arrested.
Yeah.
And slap in the head and a lawyer.
I was about to say, lawsuits following that.
Yeah. Not far behind. So that was the modeling. So, again, the tumultuousness of the system. My sister left early at 16. I got out of there at 17 to college in a small liberal arts school in Vermont. And I majored in drugs and girls and did pretty good. Those categories.
In both.
Yeah, in those categories, plural. Yeah. The other academic part, not so good.
Didn't transfer over.
No. It wasn't really part of what, you know, it wasn't, how do you learn how to study when you're high all the time? Because we smoked pot all the time in school.
No Quaaludes?
Well, there was everything that came in the door in my body. More was the drug of choice. It wasn't like there was anything that was really more better than other. You know, getting rid of the feelings of inadequacy knew no boundaries.
Yeah, anything would work. Anything that worked.
Yeah, alcohol was always a good standby because I learned how to drink on LSD and all that crap. So, you know, it's just more is better. And if one works, two works better, and 22 work even longer. And that's the way it went for quite a while. My father was in business, and the messages that we grew up with, my sisters and I, I'm a middle child of two sisters, and we all grew up with the same message: if you're not in business, you're basically a fucking loser. That's it. If you work for somebody, you don't really, are not ever going to amount to anything, whatever that really measure was. So the measure was entrepreneurship or business. And so I got caught selling drugs at 14. I got threatened with boarding school. The officer came to the house. That was one of many incidents of interaction with the law that didn't deter me from what I was on that path.
So the consequences weren't really doing anything for, you know.
Threats.
You could care less.
Well, I cared, but cared to not get caught.
Right.
It didn't stop. And the message was, stay, do it at home. This was the intrigue, because they had thrown their hands up on trying to manage this. It was, if you're going to do it at home.
Mm.
How do you leave the house?
So did the move at 14, going from
Philly
City
to
going to Cherry Hill, did that, I mean, you were probably out of place, you new friends,
more
discomfort, more need
worst.
To get high.
Yeah.
And I assume they had little experience or maybe little patience for somebody who was doing this kind of stuff.
They being parents
they
or
being
the
just
school?
The world there, the teachers, the parents.
They didn't know. It was 1970, 71. They had already given up. We were smoking cigarettes.
You could
in the courtyard.
In Center City more than you could in Cherry Hill.
There was no reason to hide.
Yeah.
Everybody was, their moral compass was already eroded.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't downtown Center City. It was like the periphery of the edge of Philly. Just, there's a big difference between downtown urban like Manhattan and Brooklyn,
mm-hmm.
right? Or something, or Queens. So, so I'm in school, I get through high school somehow, I get to college somehow. I go against my best wishes because I really don't want to go. I want to go in business with my father. because there's only one opportunity, right? You go in business. Because
right.
if you're not in business, you're thought of as a loser.
Failure.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and a failure, loser, synonymous. And he's like, no, absolutely not. Because he was in the chemical waste removal business. So think Love Canal.
Yeah.
Okay, that's the best measure for you to think about. He would pick up toxic waste from different factories in the local area, being the tri-state area,
mm-hmm.
with massive amounts of equipment, truck drivers, and a big operation with a ninth grade education.
That's
he managed
incredible.
To do this. Yeah, it's pretty incredible. And stashed a whole shitload of money somewhere because my mother tracked him down for years to find out where he and the money went.
They split up.
Yeah, because the message was as soon as my sister, my younger sister, 6 years younger than me, graduated, this was the end.
Yeah.
And that was a
stayed together for the kids, right?
Well, he made the bed, you sleep in it. That mm-hmm. was the messaging, mm-hmm. and that's what he was brought mm-hmm. up with. That's what was modeled, and that was the way it was. And sure enough, as soon as he graduated, out the door, he was gone. The parts.
And he took money with him.
We don't know.
Yeah.
Whatever. It wasn't the topic of conversation because that's not what you talk about in a nice Jewish family. You don't talk about certain things. It's mm-hmm. none of your business. You don't get a voice.
So when he split, you remained close with your mother?
There was never a real relationship. We had kind of severed because I was, shall we say, covertly incested. That would mm-hmm. be your best way. That's the new way to describe that.
Because I don't know what that means.
He was not meeting her needs. So I was that person in her life. Everything but sexual.
Oh, they say this enmeshed.
It's past enmeshment.
Oh, it's past enmeshment.
It's way past enmeshment.
They called my brother my mom's second husband. So yeah, I know what you mean.
Yeah, that would be a good description.
Yeah, okay, right? I got it.
Where I was taught everything that he didn't do.
And he was the middle child, so maybe there's a connection. I don't know. I
could show you the book. So, you know, you learn how to be that person that he was not.
Right.
And I got very good at it. And to this day, you'll find a lot of people in my life to say, oh yeah, you know, he's good at that.
Mm.
Right. So that's that kind of snippet of growing up in that kind of times. It was also the times we're talking post Woodstock. We're talking, what was the big Watkins Glen? Do you remember mm-hmm. Watkins Glen?
Yeah.
I was there for the band.
That was after Woodstock.
It was after Woodstock. Right. I was there, wrecked a car. I wrecked a lot of cars, spent a lot of time in jail.
So we're now like a common theme on Crosstalk, people wrecking cars. You think that alcohol
we actually have a requirement of at least two or three car wrecks before
you're
eligible to be
usually driving into things.
Yeah.
Not like having wrecks, but driving into things because you're busy trying to find the joint.
In law school, I took out a cinder block. You know, I took out a cinder block wall at the apartment complex. I was at in right. Coral Gables.
Yeah, but the car just kept on going.
The car's fault,
right,
not me.
Yeah, of course. That's I was a victim. Talk about victim. I was the best. I was really, really good. Carried that line all through college, all through high school, all the way up until recovery, which is when I got off that.
So tell us, you know, we've gotten a good picture of your childhood, and tell us really what was the culminating events, you know, what led up to 1987?
So I go to work intimately with my father, right?
Okay.
Because I get out of a bachelor's program and, I really want to get a master's degree. I really want to follow my passion. I studied theater. I wanted to be the next Joe Papp. Do you remember him? You're too young for Joe Papp. You
know, director.
He's a director.
No clue. Yeah. Now I know.
So it's Circle in the Square Theater. It was the beginning of Off-Broadway.
Mm.
And I am very passionate about this. Plus, I'm really good at it.
Yeah.
I really have talent. And I followed that pathway up into a waiting list at NYU. Got waitlisted there, didn't follow through with other options, wound up smoking dope, wasting time, and selling drugs to the staff that worked for my father, and he was not real happy with that. So I got fired. Jumped on my motorcycle, took a ride for 6 months, and played the movie star role. Remember Bronson? Remember
sure.
that TV show? Yeah, there it was. I was out. Got to California, saw the sunset. Spent time under a picnic table in Arizona. That was kind of like earth-shattering, right? To be picking up cans for a living because I was too prideful to ask for help. Wound up back in Miami, spent the season waiting tables.
85, 86.
This is 85, 86. No, it was even earlier than that. No, it had to be in the 70s.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was in the 70s because I was 24, 20, and is 23.
This, you're basically like working to use.
Oh, that's it. Using was the daily thing.
Arizona
was hard because I had to switch to alcohol. There was no pot. There was nothing else. So it's just alcohol at that point.
Okay.
That's when you learn to wash your teeth with gin or whatever you get your hand on. But it was always something. It was always something because not having something produced that anxiety that you mentioned earlier. It just like was just too much inside of me. So I somehow got back to Jersey and started again, which was part of the process of starting over. They let me back in the house. I'd start over, bounce back good. Came undone again. And this time, a cousin of mine. So I mentioned I had my namesake, Harold, had two sons that my father basically raised. They were the oldest of the family, Lewis and Jay, two brothers. My father did his best to parent them, which was not really successful. Lewis was a active methamphetamine user before it was popular. So he was injecting meth. He was there at Lexington, right, in Kentucky, one of the premier treatment centers of the country, the very first in the 60s and the 70s. He was there, in and out of prison, in and out of jail, all that stuff. That was our measure of addiction in the family. If you weren't shooting dope,
you're good.
You're just a drug addict. You just use drugs. You just drink. You just smoke pot. It was no big deal. That was the measure that everybody would look at. And
not the norm in a Jewish family.
No, unusual. Not the norm. Alcohol would be the norm. This was way out of the box. So Lewis lived with us intermittently. He was like my older brother, my hero. He was what I looked up to. He had my father's ear. That was helpful. Kind of paved the way for all of us in so many ways, but he also was an evil person and wound up incesting almost every woman in the family that let, it was just that kind of evil that, you know, he was lost.
Yeah.
And no excuses, no rationale, but it was just horrific. Wound up living with one of our other first cousins on the other side. I mean, that's how it was all, everybody just
insanity.
Yeah. So he's passed. So he had a brother, Jay, and I used to babysit his kids, and they all would work for my father in Mendley and da 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 da. So anyway, I got 86 again. I got out of the business and get kicked out again.
Okay.
And Jay shows up in my life. Well, I introduced him. He, unbeknownst to me, was on parole, had violated his parole, went to Las Vegas, and he's doing phone rooms.
Oh, God.
This is in the
He's
doing phone rooms, late 70s. He's doing
phone
rooms.
In the beginning.
Rooms. He's selling
HBO special on
genuine,
this.
No, this is way before that. Oh. Genuine simulated diamonds. You heard that.
Oh, God, okay.
Right? Genuine simulated diamonds. So when people hear that, I'll take it. Right? And he's good. He is really good. He comes to me with this. He says, look at this. And it's zirconia. Nobody knows what zirconia is because they only had Wellington jewels. It was glass. Zirconia looked and sounded and smelled like real diamonds.
Yeah.
It would be so real that the pawn shops that we would go to with it would throw you out to get the hell out of here because you're trying to pass something. You tell them it was fake and they would still think you were trying to steal something. That's how good it was. Now it's everywhere. Zirconia is everywhere. So this is the beginning, and he winds up getting violated. He goes to prison, leaves me with this product. I'm running around Manhattan, right, on a coke run with this great lead on how to, nobody else has it.
Yeah.
And I'm like 24 years old, and I'm in Manhattan, and I'm running out of money, and the club I'm in, everybody picks up and goes downtown. And there's nothing at downtown at that point. There's nothing at warehouses. They open up what they call it when they do those...
After hours?
Well, they open up a roller disco, because it's roller disco, four wheels.
Oh,
out of nowhere, there's a warehouse, and there's poles, and everybody's roller skating. And during this, I'm in the middle of this thing, because I have no money for roller skates, and I see this woman going around. Now, there's hundreds of people. There's a bistro ball, there's everything's happening, and somehow we
you
catch
could
each
see
other.
One woman.
One, just one. White top, A-line skirt. I can see it today as if it happened yesterday. turns out that we'd link up and wind up in 5 days on a plane to Las Vegas and get married.
Congratulations.
Good. No, better yet, on her MasterCard.
Oh, God.
And you know why? Because I had just gotten out of jail. I'm on bail. And I'm saying to my addict mind, I need a wife. I need a wife. The judge won't put me in jail if I have a wife. He won't. They will never do that. That's what I'm thinking. My logic right. is if I have a wife, I'm not going to go to jail. It made sense.
And did right? you do it with a cubic zirconia?
No, we went to Vegas and got married at the church that Elvis is at. What? I was just like, wow. And she's like, okay, great. Turns out this is my introduction to mental illness. She's on a bipolar episode beyond. Who
she's
knew?
Manic.
Who knew? Right?
This like is, The Hangover, the movie The Hangover.
This lasted 8 years and three children later.
That was only about a 90-minute movie.
Exactly. This oh is 8 years of legal marriage, 2 years of cohabitation, three children later. You've met my daughter.
Yes, I love your daughter.
I do too.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, and her brothers.
She told me she's close. There
and,
you go.
And my
are
brothers.
Close.
And her brothers. Right? Right. So those are the product of that insanity. And we stayed and managed together as co-parents until the day she died. And that was Thanksgiving 2017. She passed away from breast cancer. And that was, and the kids, everybody, you know, we're all together as a family because that was the value that we stuck with. So that's that story of like, now I'm using this whole time, all through the marriage, I'm using up until 1987 when I'm working as I always did, because that was one of the things, there was education and work. And for me, working in a restaurant gave me food and stuff to steal and money to borrow, because it's a restaurant business, it's cash. Mm-hmm. And I learned how to cook. So I've got multiple skills in that system. And
it's also like a breeding ground for drugs.
Oh.
I mean, I was a chef. That's where my...
Well, we're talking Jewish delis and bagels. We're not
okay.
I passed that mark of like learning how to do that.
I love Jewish delis.
Yeah. We're talking eggs and bacon and like run the streets and shoplift in between shifts, you know. And why aren't you at work? Well, I was in jail. You know?
Right.
That was the way the pattern was.
Right.
But I'm supporting a heroin habit at that point.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
for
okay.
not
we've
one,
graduated
but two people.
From...
Yeah, we moved just because the pain was the shame of failing as a husband and as a father, because I couldn't be around that. You know, it had come apart. So she got pregnant for the third time and we almost killed each other. Cause
was
we
she as well using?
No, she didn't eat. She couldn't get high. She was bipolar.
Right. Okay. Well, some people still do.
they use, but it didn't do anything.
Right.
So she stopped, and she loved being pregnant, and she got pregnant for the third time, and we separated for the final time before we literally killed each other, and we weren't doing a good job with the two kids we had. So that was in our best interest, and that
had a
much
total of three kids
with her. Yeah. So she was pregnant with the third child. His name's Chris. And, mm-hmm. and so we separated and stayed that way until eventually my father showed up a couple years later. And the only way she would tell him where I was is if he paid for the attorney to get divorced, which was the best thing she ever did for herself mm-hmm. and for the kids. Mm-hmm. So that was a legal ending of that. But I'm at that point, the biggest piece of shit I think that you can never look in the mirror and see. Because I'm a failed husband, I'm a failed father, I'm just a failure, right? I'm not in business, I'm not anything, but I'm not even good at doing drugs because I keep getting caught and interrupted and all this. I mean, there's nothing going good.
Criminal record.
Just like...
What year are we in right now at this story?
This is 85 to 87, okay. Right? And I'm in and out of trying to do something different. And
the beginning
it's not
of
working.
The end.
Yeah, no, the drugs aren't working. Nothing's working. Nothing's working. He shows up at this restaurant I'm working at, he being my father. I haven't seen him in 5+ years. I didn't recognize him. He walked right up to the window. You know, when you're a chef, you put stuff in the window at the little restaurant, and mm-hmm, he walks right up. He walks right up, and he says, "Hey, I hear you have a problem." That's all he said. He doesn't say hello. He says, "I hear you have a problem." It's like, yeah, what else is new? Where you been? Right? Yeah. I get back on methadone, and then 3 weeks later, I get a letter in the mail from him and the girlfriend that he's running around with. that he met in Costa Rica, that he's now caretaking for her and her four children. Oh. And doing a pretty good job, right? Because he's available, so he's doing a different thing. He must have read a book or heard something. I don't know.
Right.
He's more available. And so they send me this letter that they will put me on a plane and bring me to Florida. And I can go to treatment. And I'm terrified. Absolutely terrified. Her brother was in Hanley, in West Palm.
Oh, yeah?
Her brother's a heroin addict. That's how she kind of was pushing my father to reconnect with his family, reconnect with his children. It was all her doing. He was kind of on the edge of all of this. And so they send this letter, and I sit on it for a couple of days, and I take it to my methadone clinic, and I show it to the counselor. There's actually a counselor at the methadone clinics, because this is before Suboxone, right? This is
right,
the 80s.
Right.
And she says, she goes for a pocketbook immediately. She says, I want to give you money for a taxi, go to the airport right now. Just like that. You'll pay me back later. And I said, oh, I'll go later. I got things to do.
Of course.
I got things to do. This
so
is,
you didn't go at that point?
Not that morning, right? Because the girlfriend I was running around with, who was working at the strip club, who claimed she wasn't a hooker, was really good at what she did. She had been at this for a little bit longer than I have. I just was caught with loyalty. And so I shared it with her. And so we spent the afternoon shooting coke and chasing money and doing the same thing we always did until later that night. I called and said, get me on the plane. And so that night, 1987, I think it was October 12th.
Do you remember, like, what made you make that call? Was it just like you just...
No. We just knew.
You just knew. So it's time.
When you're living at the bottom, starts to look at like the top, right? That's the way it gets. Everything gets convoluted, and the bottom looks like the top. There's no further where to go. Jail looked like a good intervention. So I continued to commit crime. They kept putting me back on the street because it was just petty crime. I wouldn't do anything really substantial because I didn't want to really go to prison. I mean, there's just no good fun in there. The food sucks. There's no privacy. The sex is horrible. Everything about that just didn't appeal to me. So I would just do stupid stuff like shoplift. And I accumulated a number of those charges, and they kept putting me out. And I kept wind up doing the same thing.
Right.
So there was no interruption. So it was like this system of like, okay, till the next time. And then this letter came and interrupted it, and the opportunity presented itself. And honestly, I didn't think I could do this.
So you go there.
You went to the Hanley Center.
I got off a plane.
Yep.
Got to my father's on methadone now. Remember, I got a dose that morning. That night, I have no methadone in the morning. I'm going to be sick.
Yeah.
In my mind, I'm going to be crazy. I'm going to be seeking drugs because I'm on methadone and I have to have drugs. My body does, and I'm on the phone that morning, like, where can I get a visiting dose? What do I have to do? Blah, blah, blah. They say, call Hanley, and I call them, and they say, yeah, come the next day. So think Tuesday to Thursday.
Oof,
and I'm freaking out.
That's a hard 24 hours.
My father comes out with a 10-milligram Valium. He says, here, take this. I started to laugh. I said, where's the bottle? Give me the bottle, then maybe, right? Now, he's in the bedroom with the girlfriend, freebasing cocaine. Right. They won't share any either. And I'm like, what the fuck? How dare you? You bring me in this house and you don't share, right? I thought you loved me. And so that's the way that went. I'm at this Kmart shoplifting, you know.
Right.
Yeah, that's what I'm doing because that's what I know how to do. And I'm in Deerfield. And so they get me to Hanley. Hanley gives me a clonidine patch. They've never seen methadone. They've never seen a heroin addict, apparently, because they had no idea what to do with me.
Oh.
So I lasted two weeks cold turkey off of methadone.
Oof.
And I'm like looking like my ex-wife. I'm looking like really bipolar. I'm not sleeping. I can't shut up. No caffeine, nothing but anything that I'm 130 pounds. You know, I'm really like a lightweight at that point. And I don't know. I just kept following direction.
When did you start to feel better? Like, when did something click and you said, thank God I'm in this place?
I never said that.
Oh, okay.
I was never happy to be there. There was a guy selling cocaine on the payphone. You know, they still had payphones.
Wow.
I said to the guy, they give me the pamphlet to fill out. They say, write your goals down. Listen to the story. I write the goals down, and I wrote down, I want to learn how to speak Spanish. I want to learn how to juggle. I want to learn how to type. Those are the three things I write on the form. and this is this first step form or whatever it is. This is what I write down. So they're sitting me down in the office, right? And he's like this. He's as old as my dad, and he sits down like this. I'll never forget. He says, he's looking at the form, and he looks at me, and he looks at the form, and he looks at me. His name is Jerry. He says, you know, the chances of sobriety for you are like zero.
Wow.
Zero. Look at this. Look at what you write here. I said, what was I supposed to write? Because there was no tutoring. There was nothing.
Right. Oh, my God.
Makes sense to me, actually. The juggling makes perfect sense.
Yeah, it turned out to be a really good idea, right? So not long after that, I acted out in a place where they didn't think I was safe. They sent me what at that point was Savannah's. It's now Port St. Lucie Hospital, I think.
Okay.
Savannah's was the originator of the dual diagnosis label, and they couldn't sure what I was or wasn't, because I was looking pretty crazy from the methadone withdrawal. And so they had me in locked doors at that point. It's a psych hospital. And now I think I'm Steve McQueen, because I'm locked up, right? And I'm going to escape. I'm in and out of the quiet room all the time, because I'm agitated, I'm anxious, I can't shut up. I don't even know how they tolerated me. So what, they elect me president of the community. Go, what are they thinking, right?
Right.
What are they thinking? And some freaking 18-year-old has his sister bring him cocaine on visiting day.
Oh.
And then he tells me about it. And this is the turning point, because I already stood at the gate and said, I'm jumping over this gate, right? I'm going for it. And then they said, there's a big gator out there or something. And I'm like, maybe not. I had no money, no clothes. I had nothing.
Right.
And I live in a psych hospital. And I'm like, oh, this is great. Now, what's that guy's name from One Flew Over Cooper's Nest?
Mac. Mac was Nicholson. I remember, I can imitate the guy you're talking about. Mac! You know the guy who talks like that? You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
The bald guy, he's a little chubby.
Sure. Yeah. All these, and this is what's going on in my mind. And he tells me about it, and I'm now stuck again. And I go to my counselor, and I say, look, what do I do? This is what's happening. And he says, well, here's what I got to tell you. And he's, like, got a shirt and tie on. He's got this Jimmy Johnson haircut that it's, like, everything's proper. I mean, not a hair out of place. And he's living large because he's wearing a suit for a living instead of shooting dope. And sorry, no disrespect intended for the people knowing the business, but that's where he was. And he says, would you put a loaded gun on the counter of a suicide ward? I had to stop. I'm like, no, I would never do that. And he says, well, that's just what happened. That somebody brought drugs into a locked psychiatric hospital and put everybody at risk.
Yeah.
So I told him the guy's name. 15 minutes later, they bounced him out, packed him up right in front of everybody. And everybody said, you did it. You told on him.
You're
and
I the said, narc.
I'm the narc. I said, yeah, that's me. I did it because I want to live. I don't want to die.
So something switched.
That was it. And that it was a very, very critical incident in being able to be comfortable with the truth. Mm-hmm. You know, and that was a hard thing because
where did that come from?
There's a moral compass that we were taught, right? As kids, we're taught these things. You know, and we're modeled it somewhere along the lines. And somehow it got adopted into my system.
It's a fucking miracle.
Who knows? Who cares? I don't care. I don't care where or how, whatever we label it, just that's what happened. So, you know, I was listening to ESP on the way down here, you know, mental telepathy. So, you know, who knows what's anything.
Extrasensory perception.
Yeah. They put a blindfold on a kid and she can tell you what you're looking at, you know, whatever.
So you finally have the switch. You're still in a psych ward.
They sent me to another. They sent me to CARP. They got rid of me at Savannah's.
CARP is the magic word today.
They sent me to CARP.
And it's so funny because over the past 3 days, I've heard 3 stories where CARP was involved.
Mm-hmm.
And so you know,
we're talking CARP on Irish Street.
Well, yeah, but
not 45th Street. We're talking pre 45th Street CARP, where you're getting roaches off the bed. And Bobazone is still chasing the dream of having a building. And we're talking 1987, 1988. I'm waiting for a bed in what they called an assessment center, holding ground. And I'm there with 30 other people, and we're all waiting for a bed in residential to go in the continuum of care, which is all new languaging. And I'm waiting, and I'm impatient. And I see people coming in and out for meetings. And I'm like, I can do this. I got this. There's nothing that can make me ever use again. I mean, I had made a decision somewhere because I had already lost the marriage and already three businesses at least I'd already failed at. So, like, I'd already been there.
Right. And so, were you introduced at all to a 12-step program?
Well, they would bring meetings in.
Okay, AA, so there was NA. Something that was starting to click, like, I'm not going to do this. There's a solution or whatever. Not that this, you
There's a guy in West Palm named Harry Hamilton. I think he's passed by now because he was old when I met him. And Harry was a legend in West Palm. He owned a big Darth Vader building up there.
I'm telling you, this guy, you must know the guy that spoke on Thursday. I don't remember his name, but he spoke about Harry.
Yeah, Harry was the legend. Harry was the man. There was the Triangle Club. There was Oasis. All this stuff was new in the 80s. And AA was the pathway. NA was in its infancy. Nobody gave it any credibility. All that talk. And anyway, I gravitated towards that program that worked for me. I felt welcome at home in NA, and that's where I wound up hanging out. But I was pushing for outpatient IOP. I wanted to do it, and they didn't have it in place. So I left. I went AMA out of CARP, and I wound up in 24 hours at a place called Palm Beach Center for Personal Growth, originated by Sid Goodman.
I know Sid.
Uh-huh. And that's where I wound up. And so for a small amount of money, which at the time was X, you could learn how to live.
Wow.
And Sid started the extended care model, right? That was what they called it.
Yeah. And, the Florida model.
It wasn't the Florida model yet. It was extended care.
Okay.
It was
okay.
Sorry. Yeah. Don't corrupt things too soon. Because that Florida model is now Indiana, Illinois, Washington, California, Arizona. And it's just unfortunately what it is. There was the office and then there was the apartments. Mm-hmm. And you had to negotiate life all day, every day, and deal with life on life's terms. And I got integrated into the community. And I started to throw parties when I got out because I got kicked out of there because I decided to tell them the truth about going on pass with a girl at the hotel. And they were like, you can't do that. I said, what do you mean? I can't. Of course I can. This is America. What do you mean I can't do that? And they wouldn't let me borrow the books. And they wouldn't tell me where they went to meetings. It would be a repeat. Like, don't do as I do as I say.
Right.
Which I grew up with. And I was like, really not working for me. That was not working for me in any institution. I was like, how can you be that way? What do you mean?
Right. You needed something different.
I don't know. It was whatever I needed wasn't there. Other people told me to go back up north, therapeutic communities, whatever. And I had been in one of those. So I get bounced out of there. I wind up at Crossroads, and the girl I went to the hotel with let me stay at her house for a couple of weeks. I talked my father into helping me into an apartment right here in Highland across the street, and I learned how to surf and got a job at CARP.
Oh, wow.
Got a job at CARP.
What year?
1988. I had 11 months clean.
And at this point, has your relationship with your kids shifted? Are you
They're
seeing...
little. They're 2, 4, and 6. Three, five. They're no.
So you're just starting.
I am out of their lives. I'm in Florida. They're in Jersey with their mom.
Got it.
She had another baby before we got divorced. Her name's Sachi, who's my daughter. Mm-hmm. That's how, because of whatever was going on for her. So she had, and she got overwhelmed. I go to Crossroads, and this is a good part. This is the juicy Netflix story. There's a hot blonde towner story. I'm like, you could feel the chemistry, right? And I go up to her after the meeting, and I'm with my cousin, Lewis, who followed me to Florida because he got into my father's pocket, and he got in recovery and integrated and did really well for a while. We're talking with her and kibitzing after the meeting because she had talked about being from Philadelphia. Uh-huh. So this gave me that great in. I'm like, oh, I'm from Philadelphia. And you start the Jewish geography. And then she stops. She said, I know you. What is your name? And I tell her my name. She says, you're the first boy I ever kissed.
Oh, wow.
I'm like, what? Right, what? I was 7 years old. You were 9.
Full circle.
You were bunkmates with my brother, which was true. At those Jewish camps we used to go to in the Poconos. Right.
I'm familiar with them.
So there's the chemistry, there's the electricity. We're meeting in NA. We're 22, 30, however many years later, and there's all that going on, and now we're both in recovery. Well, there's this whole pathway of like, okay, this is meant to be. And her history with relationships was not real good because she was 30, 31, single, no dependents. I'm already divorced with 3. I'm not in a hurry to redo this.
Right.
She's looking at her watch. She's looking at her watch. She's looking at her clock. He's like, I want a baby. I want a baby. If you want to be with me, we're having a baby.
Right.
I'm like, So we separate. I reevaluate. I go back. I'm like, okay, I'm all in. I'll have the baby. I'm going to grad school. And that was our deal. And that's the way it played out.
And this is, what was her first name?
Dawn.
Dawn. And Dawn right now is gone?
Deceased.
She's the 2017 lady who had breast cancer.
No, that's Pauline.
Oh, that's the prior wife.
Yeah. Dawn okay. passed in 2022.
Were you with her at the time that she passed?
Well, we legally were married when she passed. We were separated and had been for 6 years. And we're negotiating that in our very small and mesh community called Delray. And because our baby that died in 2018 was essentially conceived at Crossroads.
Oh, I
mean, this
so
is our recovery baby, right? This is our family.
Was it
three
overdose?
Of us.
Was it drugs?
He exercised phenomenally poor judgment by driving one of those little scooters without eye protection, without a helmet, and on fentanyl. So you can conclude your own, you know, outcome of that. Right there on Dixie and Hidden Valley.
I see people without helmets all the time. I'm just like, why? Like,
because the insurance lobby made sure that it would happen that way. Because the insurance lobby does not want to pay for head injury, trauma, and long-term care for people that don't die from motorcycle wrecks.
So they'd rather you don't, if you don't wear a helmet, they don't have to pay.
Yeah, they'd rather you die.
Got it. Okay. So.
And that I learned while I'm with my son in intensive care, critical care, with tubes coming out of every freaking part of his body, including his head, to relieve the pressure while he's seizing. And we're deciding. What to do?
I'm so sorry.
And so we let him go.
So sorry.
Because there was no quality of life left for him. There was, according to the measures, there was not going to be any quality of life for him to really grow to. And the reason he was in the hospital was because the rules in EMT world, paramedics, is if there's a heartbeat on the victim, they have to take him to the hospital. And they can't let him die on the side of the road.
Did you know he was on fentanyl? Did you know he was starting to use?
He was in and out of treatment since he was 12.
Oh, man.
This is the long, the 15-year battle of to chip off the old block.
How is that? Was there? What was,
he was in Renaissance.
Oh, he. Oh, God, maybe I know him. Oh, wait, I think.
2016.
I
got him out of
2016.
Jail. I got him out of jail with the condition that he goes to Renaissance. And my intervention was not for him. Because he was already
of course.
The way he was.
Yeah.
If anybody could help him, it would have been people at Renaissance. The people that, anyway, it was for her. Because she had enmeshed him into her world. Mm-hmm. And that was the big battle between her and I, was the choice of parenting styles.
Were you the hard love, let's not enable it?
Okay, look, I walked over him on the front lawn while the sprinklers are going off because I wouldn't let him in the house.
Right.
And when I went to work, she would let him in the house, feed him, clothe him, and give him money because she loved him.
It's so hard.
You can imagine.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can. You don't want to.
Right.
Yeah, you can. You've heard it, seen it. I lived it.
I've heard it. I've seen it. Absolutely. It's.
She had a great set of rules for everybody. Including her brother, who would she would say on the phone, put him on the street, pick him out, kick him out, and then when it came to her son, come on, and she would say, okay, because she loved me too. So that's the way that. So that's how that played out. And finally came to a conclusion. The last phone call that I got was from her, and we knew because we had just walked down the corridor of a hospital in Boynton. With a dear friend of ours whose son had overdosed and died. And we went to say goodbye and we looked at each other and said, this is going to be us. This is going to be us. And a year later, it was near to the day. And these are the two kids that used together, right? they used together, the two boys.
I'm sure I knew him, and I'm so sorry.
Your son's name was?
Jay. After my cousin, right? Jay Jonas. Yeah.
Yeah, I was around Renaissance then. I'm wondering whether I ever bumped into him.
I was there. He sabotaged his way out of the family program.
We were there at the end of 2016, so he was either...
It was a spring.
IOP. Yeah, so he was probably, you know, one of the sober supports that came around.
No, he wasn't.
Oh, okay.
No, he had already violated the guidelines by stealing his mother's computer when we lived in the townhouses.
Oh, right, in the I building.
Yeah.
Sid was not there at
that
time.
No,
he was already gone.
Sid had been
Robert
gone.
Robert Hoffman was there, I think.
Robert Johnson was there. Mm-hmm. McNally, Brad was there.
Ernest. Ryan Sorte. Ryan Hansen,
yeah.
I mean.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Ernest.
Ernest's still there.
Old school people. Mike just passed. You know, I've known Mike. I just had coffee with Michael Herbert this morning. You know.
I'm sorry, what?
Michael Herbert, you know him?
Yeah.
We had coffee together this morning.
Oh,
I thought I heard
Mike thing. McNally passed away.
Oh my God! I was like, I'm sorry.
No.
I love Michael Herbert, and he's been on our podcast. Yeah, it was a 3-hour long extravaganza.
He can do some talking,
but his story is so incredible. But let's get back to you. How was it to lose a son in sobriety? Like, did using ever cross your mind, or not even close? Like, not even in a
getting out of pain. Is pretty typical for an addict and for me. Did I choose drugs? No. Did I choose drugs when dawn passed? No. Is it a testament to my commitment? Look, I made a commitment to stay clean and not die a long time ago.
Right.
I make the same decision every morning. This is what I suggest to people. Every day I make the same choice. And no matter what happens today, I'm not getting high. And that's that.
So you're a part of the no matter what club.
It's like, how's that going to change anything? It's only going to delay the inevitable of overwhelming pain and sorrow and sadness. It's just temporary.
So
I don't know about a no matter what club. It's just it's every day. They told me in the very beginning, you only got to stay clean today. So I got a little thing that said JFT on it just for today. Yeah. And a word for religiously, literally, took my Star David, put it away. It's JFT. It was it. And it was just like, okay, I can do that. I can do a day. And if I couldn't do a day, I can do 10 minutes. They said, oh, yeah, start a new day. Oh, I got that. I can do that. And then I became a success. And that's where the self-esteem started to build with those really, really, what you would say, monumental achievements. But everybody else does this all the time. Most everybody uses alcohol. And they put it down. I don't have a stop switch.
Yeah, me neither.
I don't have a stop switch.
So you went to school. You got some certifications, some degrees. And...
Well, at CARP, it was pathway to certification, right? CAP, all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was like, you can't get anywhere in an industry like this without a master's degree. And I had always wanted a master's degree, so I wound up finding a program that would help me get a master's, which was Antioch University. It was the original School Without Walls, experiential learning, which is the way I best learn on the job.
Mm-hmm.
And did that. A two-year program took me 5 years because I'm working two jobs and now supporting 5 kids.
Wow.
All right. So, and then I kept rejecting my thesis proposals. So I got more suicidal than ever wanting to use because I was like, I can't get past this freaking program.
And what was the degree exactly?
Which Master's one? In Counseling.
Master of
Arts in Counseling.
Yeah. What was the ultimate thesis that got approved?
We were doing batterer's intervention when OJ broke. And finally I got a new supervisor on campus that said, what are you doing here? I said, well, the previous person would not accept anything. And she said, these are amazing, blah, blah, blah. Let's get you out of here. So I submitted the program we created, a batterer's program. Which wasn't too foreign for me because I grew up with that shit.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So it was all about the Duluth model. We brought the Duluth model into the 15th Judicial Circuit here in Palm Beach County. They were doing anger management, which was basically a joke.
Mm-hmm.
And that the batterers program came in. We did the Duluth model here through Harmony House, the shelter.
Mm-hmm.
I've been on a rescue mission with women after watching my mother be helpless her whole life. So that kind of stuck. I got out of the program, and then I realized that I couldn't really get ahead to where I really needed to go because I had all these children that needed all these things like education, cars, insurance, how am
I? I have a guess. Can I make a guess? Your own business.
Yes. When I was allowed to, right? So I started an IOP with intervention strategies. I think in 91, I think I had an associate certification. I wrote a program, started an outpatient program, and then I got a consulting job to help a guy start a treatment center. And I wrote his policy and procedure manual. And I said, okay, you need to give me a resume. And just like you're looking at me now,
yeah.
He looked at me like that. He like, what's a resume? I said, well, you're the executive director of the treatment center. You have to do this. And he says, well, and I said, I can't believe it. Somebody gave him keys to the property, which turned out to be Behavioral Health BHOP,
yeah.
That property on Canada Court.
Heard, yes.
He had the keys to this place, all the buildings, and he had people living there, and
he had
running.
No experience.
He used to drink.
Well,
and that was good enough.
Everyone seems to think that these days.
This was 94.
But still, now these days, 94. I meet kids. So
their motives are. Will come, and so I.
Yeah.
I said, well, fuck. Well, if he can do this, I take my son's bar mitzvah money. I go buy an apartment building. Great. I put a down payment on an apartment building, thinking I'm going to get a second mortgage on my house because I have a house. Right. They started to laugh at the bank. They said, how do you even have this house? Because somebody co-signed it. That's how I had it.
Yeah.
So I couldn't get a mortgage. Dawn and our new baby is at Mommy and Me classes and befriends another woman whose husband is very knowledgeable in real estate and apparently very successful financially, co-signs the building, co-signs the mortgage. Because he has an adopted son who's an alcoholic. That's his
intent. And what was it called?
We called it Recovery Zone.
Okay.
So I went from one apartment building to 50 beds in 3 years.
Amazing.
While I'm working full time at the hospital, blah, 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 right? Because that's what you do, what you got to do.
I'm curious. Your dad was alive at this time?
Up until 2000. Well, he died in 96. So I bought the building in 95. He died in 96, never saw it.
He never saw any of this or didn't?
He only knew I had 8 years clean and I was a good dad.
Okay.
Because I would bring my children
right.
there for him to
well,
see
that's
and
something.
Be a part. And that was a lot. That was everything. For him to say that one day, he looked at me,
yeah.
just like we were looking at each other.
Nice. Nice. I'm happy for you. I'm happy for him that you had that opportunity.
Yeah.
I compare that to coming up to the kitchen with the glass.
Yeah.
I hear you have a problem.
Yeah.
And that's
yeah, he was
really
there
to something
see it.
To be proud of.
He saw the kids, and he measured that against what he wasn't. That's what he saw.
That's amazing.
Because the therapist said, your only job is to break the cycle of dysfunction. That was your job.
Did you ever see the person who said that, you know, on the juggling Spanish and typing list, did you ever see that guy again who said you won't be successful?
No, he said your chances of sobriety
were
zero.
Yeah.
Right, or zero.
Yes.
No, I just got kicked out and kept on going
okay.
and stayed in the lobby until they gave me my money back, which wasn't my money. It was Max, my dad. It was his money. And I said, we're not leaving until you get your money back. Because he'd given him, like, I don't know, whatever it was, $5,000 at that time, which was a lot of money.
Yeah, know? Absolutely.
And I was there for 10 days or 2 weeks. I said, you're getting your money back. And he got his money back, and then he gave it to Savannah's. And,
so tell us now, you know, what recovery starts to look like, what it looks like today. Tell us about your company.
Okay. That incident of with my father and then him passing was significant because I was able to buy freedom and then parlay the inheritance that he managed to not
squander.
He didn't squander money. He hid it from my mother. He gave it for me and my sisters. And I managed to do what I needed to do, which was be sitting here today and not go out and get a Lamborghini or a Ferrari, because it was only a car. That was the value. It's only
right.
a car. No matter what, at the end of the day, it's only a car. It's going to mm-hmm. get you from here to there.
Mm-hmm.
Everything else
mm-hmm.
is just what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And I took that to heart. And the other piece that I remember him sharing with me one day was, do never forget where you came from. And I came from living on a cardboard box in Camden. That's where he found me, right at that restaurant. That's where I would have. And that was it. And never forgot that.
I picture you underneath the picnic table, too.
Yeah. Well, I was still living large then. I had a motorcycle. Then when I was on the ground in Camden, we had nothing but rats running over us, and she managed to manipulate us into a tenement. You know, that's, we were getting ready to dig in for the winter. It was October. It's cold up there.
Yeah.
It's cold on the street.
Your story is incredible, and we haven't even scratched the surface of what you've been able to do since...
Learning how to mature and how to grow up and how to listen and how to be teachable and how to learn and how to shut the fuck up.
So tell our people who are watching, how did you learn to shut the F up?
Yeah,
what did you do?
I got reprimanded in agencies and broke all the rules until I knew I wasn't a fit in those places. I would look at the rules, and there would be rules in between the rules that I continued to violate and then didn't know, because they're learned after the fact. They're representative of the family system. It's the same kind of hierarchical bullshit that I was resistant towards as a kid, and I wasn't a fit there. So being self-employed was really my best pathway. I have challenges playing in the sandbox with other people, because I think I'm so smart. Mm. So I get this level of arrogance and conceit and you know, some of it's probably true and some of it is not. It's not my issue. I overcompensate in so many ways because of, I lost 20 years of my life. So I was in a hurry. I was in a hurry to do a lot of things. Having kids was a big driver. I would not suggest my pathway to anybody. The only pathway I would only recommend is to wake up and do the same thing you did yesterday, which is not use. Right, that's it. If you don't use, everything has a chance. It has a chance. Because once you start, you got to start all over again. And that's one of the biggest drivers that was, for me, was I got tired of starting over. I got tired of starting over and starting over and starting over and licking my wounds and not doing the same stupid stuff over again until I learned that I could stop and pause and process and think differently. And see what could possibly happen, X, Y, and Z, as opposed to just X, which was always X.
Right.
Always X. So,
slowing down appears to be a really important
for me.
Yeah.
And I'm not ADD. I'm not hyperactive. I'm just in a hurry because I gave up 20 years. It literally, like Cheech and Chong, was up in smoke. I had nothing to show for it. I had three kids that I was not really good at doing anything with other than staying out of their life. That was the best I could do for a period of time. Mm-hmm. And that was the best gift I gave them for Christmas one year, or Hanukkah, really, was a clean father. I had to settle with that. And that was an amazing gift, because after that, they were living with me. And after that, they were getting bar bat mitzvah. And after that, they were graduating high school and going to college. And after that, and after that, and after that, all of the process was happening. And it always started with not using.
And those gifts that you describe with your kids make me think of the gift that you and your father exchanged right before he passed.
That's it.
Same kind of thing.
Yeah.
So, you know, when you get down to it, you know, all kinds of different successes.
That is the success.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the wealth of that, the legacy, even with the trauma and the losses. The people that were here just before I got on were at the coffee house. And Dawn was an integral part of the coffee house. Dawn made the coffee house run the entertainment component of it. Mm-hmm. She did. We had Del Rey Got Talent. We had a talent show every month, and it would pack. And we had bands every week. And it was a microcosm of a social entity that has not been replicated. People have tried elsewhere in other places, and it's never been the same.
Right.
It's never been the same. They had Club Soda. They had all these different attempts, but it was never what we had.
Right.
And you can't recapture that. It was like a time capsule. Mm.
And of course, you were the featured act juggling.
Well, I was just behind the scenes. I wasn't at the front. Everybody else was out front. But you know, there was this.
He was typing the script.
The
back.
Cute girls that were at the counter selling the coffee and the drinks and with their boy whatever. And Dawn was doing her thing, and everybody was doing their stuff. And it was a smooth running machine.
Great.
It was going good. We didn't make any money. Because we had the New York Times there with the overdoses and suicides in the motel, which was adjacent to the coffee house, And that was the deal breaker for me when I did Jay overdosed, when fentanyl came into town, Jay overdosed. And I let him get out of jail, right? And I let him stay at the motel when I was against my better judgment. And she's like, please just let him stay there just till he gets situated. And
is this the one in
Delray?
What's it called?
It used to be the Delray Inn, uh-huh. And now it's the Atlantic Hideaway.
Yeah.
Right? And so we let Jay stay there, and I don't know, not even 24 hours, he's blue is your jeans, and they're coming out, he's not breathing, and I'm like, get the fuck, you know, and there was Narcan was new,
yeah.
So the cops come, and unfortunately, my mouth to mouth, whatever, I kept him alive long enough. This is my son.
Man.
This is my son. And, so they hit him with the Narcan. They take him to Bethesda. I'm shaking. Imagine, right? You're doing an OD on your own kid, and I called on, and she screams and under the phone and drops the phone and runs to the emergency room. Now I'm left by myself, shaking and trembling, and nobody's. I'm looking. What the fuck? What about me? What about me? And so I get in the car when I could drive after I called some people who settled me down. And I go up there, and he's now handcuffed to a bed because they arrested him because they're mad at him.
Yeah.
Because he had been problematic in the community by stealing my truck and vandalizing different areas of Delray with tagging. And they got him on camera. And so... this is 2016, and he's handcuffed to a bed, and she's there wringing her hands, and my baby, and I'm like, what the fuck? What do you mean, your baby? This is a grown man. He's 25 years old. You know, this isn't new. He's in and out of treatment, in and out of jail. We've been doing this since he's 14. When is enough enough? So I'm taking pictures of him. And my antisocial son has got tattoos that are just... horrific. They're just horrific. And she's like, don't do that. How could you do that? And I said, this is the product of our efforts. What do you mean? And so we're having, and then I left. And he talks the officers into letting him out of the handcuffs to go to the bathroom. And of course he runs.
Of course.
He runs. And he's got nothing on. And he's coming off of an overdose. He's got tubes in him and shit. Mm. And he runs. And of course they have to tase him. Of course, and now they're mad at him again because now he's resisting arrest and fighting with them, and they give him more charges, and then I bailed him out to Renaissance. Yeah. And that was the beginning of the end, which could have been different had he gone back to Israel because we sent him on his birthright trip.
Right.
And made sure he got to go, and he came back better, clean. And I said, get in the car, I'll take you to the airport. You go do your Aliyah, go. What about mom? I said, well, I'll send her.
Yeah, go.
I'll send your clothes. I'll send your girlfriend. I'll send whatever. Get in the car. Let's go right now before you change your mind.
Yeah.
I got things to do. You don't understand. You know, the usual.
Yeah,
usual,
yeah.
Not even 90 days later, he's dead.
Gosh, I'm so sorry.
That's how quick it goes. Just like that. So the preciousness of life, the gift of life, to what we have in recovery is just such a gift that people just don't value as much as I would like them to value. Ask me when we sat down, do I help people? Well, I don't know. I'll never know. I'm not here for gold stars. I'm not here for pats on the back.
So and, you know, is there anything that you can... I know a lot of parents who struggle with their kids, especially I have one in mind, who struggle with their kids in mind and don't know what to do because their kids are on fentanyl and they're afraid if they cut them off.
Okay.
They're afraid that if they cut them off, they're going to die.
They're going to die anyway.
But that's what I...
Okay.
So what is...
fentanyl's a marijuana now.
I know.
Okay.
I've heard. I'm glad I missed that boat.
So the anxiety of your parent, or this is the hostage taking that the kids are doing, the parents are afraid they're going to lose their... They already lost their kid. They can't compete with drugs. The parents cannot. Nobody can compete with drugs until the drugs wear off. Nobody can compete. Wives, husbands, girlfriends, doesn't matter. They lost them. They're walking dead. It's just a matter of when, not if.
Yeah.
Right? That's the sad part. And that's the reality they don't want to deal with. And as soon as they deal with that reality, the better they'll be, because their anxiety will go down and they'll reconcile the fact that they did their best and they just love their kid.
Yeah.
You know, but they're going to love him to death. And I'll show them pictures of this, the gravestone, because I love my son. I love my, you know, and I watch his mom love him to death. No consequences, no nothing that we'd ever learn from.
Yeah.
Except that he could charm his way out of anything. I mean, he had girlfriends put him in treatment. He had girlfriends put him in halfway houses. Then there's his mom. He was better than me. He was better than me at charming, you know, the pants off of people.
Well, that could have been you. It could have been you.
It was me.
But you didn't end up the same way, probably because the drugs in those days weren't like the drugs in these days.
You know? Maybe. I mean, but fentanyl, he got caught with Bukowski and wanting to be, a writer, and he was going to be this, and he just got caught in his brain of delusion. Mm-hmm. I knew my talent was limited. I also had kids, you know. He only had overdoses. He didn't have kids.
Let's talk about what's happened since 2006. When did he 16, pass 18 or 16?
He passed in 18. And then Dawn, with her broken heart and her suicidality, like every freaking day after that, 22. Because it was a challenge. And so we managed to negotiate that. She passed away in an RV, you know, like a driveway home, motorhome.
She took her life or?
No. Well, I would say no, not deliberately. The incident, it was like a TV show, NCIS or something. I got a phone call one night. Mm-hmm. I need your help identifying a body. I'm like, what? I'm having dinner. What are you talking about? We have is this bracelet. And they sent me a picture on my phone of a bracelet. And then you recognize this? I said, who am I talking? What is this? What is? And they gave me the lowdown of an RV that caught on fire on 95 right outside Jacksonville in Georgia. And we don't know how it started. All we know is that it blew up between the gasoline and the propane. Like Lethal Weapon. Remember that movie when it just blows up on the beach?
Yeah.
His motorhome was... And she passed fast. Fortunately, she had no suffering, which is all I asked about. And smoke inhalation. And that was that. It was just like, what? Like, what?
Wow.
2022. And so the shock of that on top of the other loss, it was just like walking through somebody else's movie for a pretty long period of time. So there was no like, oh, I'm going to go get high. I want a stiff drink. It was like, that wouldn't even, no.
Right, of course not.
This is, no. It was, the shock was like numbing enough that we don't need, that's how it was, like a cocoon. Yeah. On top of, you know, this is my recovery family. This is what was destined. And then it was gone.
Wow.
The remnants of it was gone, except for pictures and memories. And
that's crazy.
And so the kids lost their stepmom, you know, which was, she was an integral part of Ariel.
Yes. She,
amazing.
Daughter told me she had a great relationship with her. She was awesome and everything.
And then we had a grandchild and she didn't get this. She got cheated. The grandchild got cheated out of grandma. All that stuff. He was a year old when she passed. His name's Arrow. So Jonathan came to live with us, Thomas and stepmom, at 6 months pregnant. And she did. She was amazing with those two and with the ones. But when it came to ours, there was this whole other set of rules and a whole other set of values and a whole other, like, and everybody was just like scratching their head, like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
Like, what happened? What is this time machine going on? So that's how that played out. And we managed.
One of the things I want to ask you about is, you know, we first connected with our desire to have you on Crosstalk. Is I know you do a lot in the South Florida community to work with people who are suffering from substance use dependency, and you do a lot both in terms of meeting with people one-on-one. Could you talk a little bit about what things look like today in terms of your professional life and some of the things that you're into, because I know you do some really terrific things.
Thank you for that. And I got licensed in 96 as a therapist, and I've been practicing. I keep a small caseload because of the business, And that was a priority, and juggling the both of them, and juggling being a husband and being a business owner and being a dad, and the juggling.
So you learned how to juggle.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I can teach you right now. Because I have tennis balls I carry with me and teach you how to juggle. Because there's a book, Juggling for the Complete Klutz. And there's a way to teach people how to do this 10 minutes. And it's really amazing because you're juggling. We're all juggling different roles every day.
Yeah.
In every time instance. So
did you learn Spanish?
I'm finishing. Yeah. I did learn Spanish.
Amazing. So your list is complete.
I figured you type. On a 4-line, what do you call those things? LED typewriter. They had
word
processors.
Oh, I remember those. Yeah.
That's what I had for my thesis.
God, my dad had those in his office, and I was the pretend secretary.
That's what it was. And my professors, then I went to school, they said, what are you complaining about? We had to use carbon paper. You had carbon, and they would erase in 3 times and triplicate.
Yeah, my first copy machine in my law office, you had to mix the black sand and put the paper one at a time through a piece of plastic. Yes. Through the, we were very happy to get a copy.
Yeah, yeah. It's amazing.
Are you being serious?
I am.
Yeah. And you could smell the mimeograph. The mimeograph paper.
44 years ago. Mimeograph.
The mimeograph paper. You get that feeling like sniffing gas. It was like,
that's older than I'm even alive. So, So
what happened now? So I saw the motel in 2016 because of the toxicity of all the people that were coming there. I'd had enough. The suicides, the overdoses. So it just got saturated. I couldn't hold on. I didn't want to. I didn't want to bad enough. So we separated the day of closing. We separated for the last time, Dawn and I. And she lived in a marital home, and I wound up living in different apartments around town, and slowly disintegrated the rest of the real estate that I had acquired and supported this, whatever we were doing. And I'm practicing all this time. I picked up more clients. I'm running the website, sober.com. That was a very successful venture. We sold advertising to the industry. We had a whole continuum of care. We were the very first ones online that started that because parents didn't know where to go find anything. And there was the big hustle with the Yellow Pages, and people were buying covers of the Yellow Pages, and the phone rooms were just starting, and we were the internet. We were on the internet. We were doing websites for people. We were doing SEO. We were doing it all, and had a staff and all that crap.
By the way, some people may not know what Yellow Pages are.
Yes, it was way back in the day.
No, there is yellowpages.com.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's still a thing.
But it's .com. Not
nobody
paper.
Knows that there used to be a book.
On top of the refrigerator.
Yeah. Or underneath my chair so I could see
it. And a stank of newsprint.
So we ran the website just venture. Like that, right? And so I sold that finally for the last time. I got out of advertising because it's so basically, for me, very shallow. It didn't really contribute.
Right.
It didn't contribute. It's just generating revenue. It served a purpose. I let somebody else have it. Let them have fun. And then I got into this entity of lifestyle, because now a large percentage of the population is choosing not to use alcohol.
Yes.
Choosing.
Movement.
Not because they're alcoholic.
Right.
They're all resistant to the label.
Well,
that's not good for you.
Well, now they want to add a cancer warning to alcohol. I don't know if you guys have heard. But
yesterday.
It went through.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Enjoy smooth, satisfying, sober life. Mm-hmm. Drown the stigma.
Oh, I love drown the stigma.
Because that's
delish.
The problem. So our ad is change the conversation. That's why we have a big ad, right? Is change the conversation to what people are talking about, because they don't talk about the things that they need to talk about. They talk about how much money they have or don't have, their debt service, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And they need to talk about their kid in the living room and in their bedroom hiding on the internet and the internet addiction and gambling addiction and all the things that are going on right under their nose because they don't want to talk. And so this is what we're trying to do.
I love it.
And what a crusade to do that with this. We did a big handout on Old School Square New Year's Day. We were handing out bottles of water. And people were like, what is this?
Well,
why are you giving this to me? They were really hesitant. They were like afraid to take it. Like, it's sealed. What are you worried about? And they were scared. They were really, really. And then if they see it, we put this down. It's, what is that? That's the idea. That's why we have the horse and the water.
So can I buy this online?
Amazon.
Amazon?
Or the website. You go to the website, soberlife.com, and it takes you to the Amazon store, and you can get it there.
And just in case anybody's looking for it, there's no E in sober. It's
correct.
SOBRLIFE.com. com.
And we can add it to the show notes, so we'll definitely add it as a link the show notes and on the website and everything.
$1.50 a bottle. It's a very competitive price.
Yes.
Quite a journey you took us on. You're a smart guy.
Maybe.
You weren't as smart early on as you are today.
Okay. I think it was there, I just didn't know how to use it.
What advice would Dr. Harold Jonas give young Dr. Harold Jonas before he was a doctor? If he could give some advice at some point, you can pick the time, maybe growing up years, maybe 14, 15. What advice would you give yourself? Because I'm hoping somebody listens to this advice and it somehow sparks something in one of our listeners.
So I was sponsoring a guy recently. It was like talking to my younger self. And he got his ear clean. And then we disconnected. And all I told him that night that we disconnected, which was recent, is to be teachable and no matter what, not use. Right? So that's what I passed on to him, despite whatever challenges that we had together. And I was just like talking, he's in such a hurry, he always have two kids. It's a repeat. He met his wife on the freeway and they got married. And then I have kids. It was just like, wow, stick around long enough, you hear your story. And it's true. The advice I would give my younger self is to listen to your parents, because they have usually 20 to 30 years experience in life ahead of you. And the things that they have to share may not be the way you want them delivered and the way you want to receive them, but they're usually on the mark, right? That's what I missed. I just missed that of respect for that, for my elders, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Despite how dysfunctional they were as people and immature they were as people and as parents, they still have that experience of living and negotiating, problem solving that I did not have. And I knew all the answers, but I still did not have any questions to put them to. I did learn that.
Right? I like that.
I like that. We've never heard that one before.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'll let you close out then.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
Oh, well.
Really appreciate
Stereo.
It.
Stereo.
Yeah.
Really appreciate you being here. And the things that we, I guess what we got to tell you guys that are listening is like and subscribe, follow us, smack that bell, send us your comments, tell us what you like, what you want us to do more of. And on behalf of Irene and Dr. Jonas, thanks for watching. Thanks for listening. And we'll see you next time on Crosstalk Podcasts.